Usually around this time of retreat, one of the problems which people face is thinking, oh my God, only a couple of days to go and I haven't got anything yet. So today I was going to talk about using your wisdom instead of your efforts to understand the path of meditation and to overcome the obstacles to meditation. Because sometimes thoughts like that, oh my goodness, I've been meditating, I don't know how many days now, 5, 6, 7 days, and there's only a couple of days to go, and I haven't got anything. What am I going to tell my friends after the retreat, when the noble silence is gone and people ask me, how did you do? And I've got nothing to say. Well, I did a lot of sleeping. I managed to reach that stage. So why is it that so far that some of you haven't yet got into some nice meditation? What is the problem? So sometimes what happens is people get blockages in their meditation and they just keep on plugging away and plugging away and plugging away, and still nothing happens. And instead of keeping doing the same old things, we try and use wisdom in our meditation just to stand back and see what's going on. Now, Ajahn Brahm says all you need to do is this, you do that, and all these wonderful things happen. Why haven't they happened yet? What is the problem? And that degree of reflection, now, is what we call gaining insight into the path of meditation. And by reflecting in that way, you can usually see the problem, and as soon as that problem is seen, it goes away straight away. When I'm meditating and I come across a blockage, you get so far and for some reason you can't go any deeper, instead of persisting, I stop, pause, and find out what's going on. Remember, this is a path of letting go, so it must be something I'm attached to, something I'm not abandoning. There's some place where I'm still controlling, which is why I can't go deeper. So I look around, and of course I've been meditating for such a long time now, for me it's pretty easy to recognize the old blockages, see them straight away. And the wonderful thing, as soon as you see what the problem is, the moment after you've noticed it, the problem disappears. This is very similar to what you read in the suttas of Mara. Mara, this bad guy who's always stopping people and making progress in their meditation, always trying to prevent people from becoming enlightened. And this Mara fellow, whenever it tries to stop you, you don't need to fight it, you don't need to go to war with Mara. The way to overcome Mara is to look at Mara and say, Mara, I know you. And then Mara always has to go away. It's just with the wisdom, it's a power to overcome those blockages. So let's try and see one of those blockages, one of the greatest ones for you during this retreat, is expectation. Especially because I've given all of these talks talking about delightful breath and jhanas and nimittas as well, and I make it sound so easy. Actually, it is easy if you'd follow instructions, but sometimes we don't follow those instructions, and one of the instructions you don't follow is just one of the first ones which I gave, one of the ones which I got from Ajahn Chah. We meditate not to attain things, we meditate to let things go. Not to attain, but to let things go. Not to attain, but let things go. Not to attain, but let things go. Because a lot of times the people that start meditating said, right, this is it, now I'm going to get my nimittas. And that's trying to attain something. It's not letting it go. And it's that very desire and craving in the mind which makes the obstacle. So sometimes if that happens to me, I'm meditating there and my nimitta doesn't come. And I look to myself, yep, I know, because I want it to come. I said, just let it go. I don't care. Nimitta comes, nimitta doesn't come. I'm totally equanimous. And then the nimitta comes. One of the other teachings I've given, which makes this very clear, and I usually give this in most of the retreats, is that it's so hard for people to understand what letting go actually is, or rather how to let go. But fortunately, the Buddha taught the four ways of letting go. And those four ways of letting go are found in one of the most famous and well-known teachings of the Buddha, in the first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, in the Buddha's explanation of the Third Noble Truth. The Third Noble Truth, letting go of craving is the end of dukkha, is nibbana. So letting go of craving, he gave the four ways to do that. And the first one is called chaga, which is generosity, liberality, giving. Now what that means is not just giving donations. Some people give donations, but is that letting go? Because sometimes people give a donation and they expect their name to be put on the board. So in Australia we don't call that giving. We call that buying advertising rights. If you give a big donation, it's Ajahn Brahm Hall, because I gave a lot of money for this hall. Now that's not giving, that's just buying advertising rights. Or sometimes people give a donation to the temple if their cancer is healed. Again, that's doing a deal, that's doing business. So real generosity, real giving, is giving expecting nothing back in return. Not your name on a plaque, not thanks in a newsletter, not even any recognition whatsoever. Giving expecting nothing back in return is real charity. Which is why some of the great donors are anonymous. Sometimes they just give and you don't know who put that money in the donation box. Who put that big bank draft in there? Just don't know who it was. Because they want to give expecting nothing back in return. They don't even expect good karma back. They just give because it needs to be done. Now that is what we call chaga. Giving, expecting nothing back in return. So how does that relate to your meditation? The next time you cross your legs and sit down on your cushion, make that an act of generosity, an act of giving. You're going to give that hour to the Buddha, expecting nothing back in return. You don't even expect to be free of dullness. You don't expect to be able to watch the breath. You're just going to give all of your energy, all of your attention to this meditation with no expectations. Now that's called letting go. And that works. So if you're getting a blockage in your meditation, you're not getting as deep as you had hoped, the next time you're meditating, just say, this is my act of generosity. I'm going to give my mindfulness to this moment, making peace, being kind, being gentle. That's enough for me. I'm not going to want anything. I'm going to give, and I have no expectations of anything back in return. And if you can do that, because you're not expecting things, the mind gets very peaceful, very still, all the tension disappears, and then you get deep meditation. So that's the first way of letting go, not expecting anything back in return. So if you have a block in the meditation, just check, am I expecting something Am I wanting something to happen? And if you are, that is a problem. That's Mara. And as soon as you recognize him, say, no, no expectations. I'm just really happy just being here. This is my gift of charity towards the Buddha. That's enough. Whatever happens, who cares? Then you let go. The second way of letting go is called patinissaga, which is abandoning things, to see how much you can throw away. And the simile which I've used for that is a simile of the hot air balloon. I don't know if you've seen hot air balloons in Penang, but these are these huge balloons, and you stand or sit in the basket underneath, and the balloon flies high into the air. It can only fly so high, and you're standing in there and it won't go any higher. So what do? There are sandbags in that basket, so you throw the sandbags out, hoping there's no one underneath, so it doesn't fall on anyone's head. But you throw them out, and as soon as you throw that weight out, the basket goes higher. Every time you throw something out, the basket goes higher and higher and higher. And that's just like meditation. Every time you throw out one of your attachments, every time you throw out one of your possessions, in meditation this is, you go higher and higher and higher. So what are the sorts of things you throw out in meditation? First of all, you throw out your past and your future, because that is very heavy, weighs you down, because most of the time you spend hour after hour going over a past which you cannot change, worrying about a future which is uncertain. Total waste of time, and that keeps you low down to the ground. If you throw those things out, you go very high. So you go very high when you throw out the past and the future. And then what keeps you down? All this stupid thinking. Thinking, naming, having a commentary about what's happening. And all that thinking needs to be thrown out. So every time you see a thought, that's a junk thought, throw it out. Every time there's another idea, throw it out. These are all rubbish. As I said the other day to you in one of the talks, this is like spam on your computer. So every time there's a thought, delete. Another thought, delete. Another thought, delete. Until it just becomes an automatic. As soon as a thought arrives, delete. And after a while they stop coming. You're throwing them away. And once you're thrown away all these excess thoughts, you go really high. And the next thing you have to throw out is all these feelings in the body, all these sounds in your ears, which can be so distracting. It's so hard to find any silence. And after a while you think, why am I listening to that stuff? People are talking. Why do you have to listen to it? It's really weird that we can't control our hearing. It's any sound, and straight away we want to hear it. Any noise, we have to listen to it. It's none of your business. So after a while we throw away our hearing. In other words, we're just not interested. Anyone makes a noise, anyone's talking, it's just not our business. That is not hard to do. Many people can cut off their sense of hearing. Ordinary people, such as this couple in Perth, they were Malaysians living in Perth, and they told me this story. They were embarrassed about it, but I thought it's a great story to share with others, which shows how easy it is to let go of your sense of hearing. Because they were at home, sitting on the sofa, watching a movie. And once the movie had finished, one of them got up to go to the toilet, and the other one got up to make themselves a cup of tea. And as they got up from the sofa, they realized that just behind the sofa, things had changed. Because many of their expensive possessions were missing. They soon discovered a burglar had been into their house and come into the room where they were watching the TV and literally stolen things from right behind their back, maybe only 2 feet behind them. They were such a cheeky burglar. And they hadn't heard anything because they were too interested in the movie. If only we could be that interested in our meditation, so interested in our meditation, that people come, people go, we don't even hear them. Now that's possible for you to do that. Why? It's because they're not interested in all those sounds, they're interested in the movie. And if you, as I said the other day, put value, you know, into this path of meditation, this is really important, then you won't be able to hear the sound of the dogs or the sound of the people or the sound of the cars. You only want to hear those things because you're a bit distracted, you're not really happy and content with the meditation. So throw all that stuff out. And when you throw all that stuff out, throw all the feelings in the body out, all you're left with now is the breath. See, these are the stages of meditation. As you throw things away, you're left with less and less and less to occupy your mind. And as you throw these things away, you go higher and higher and higher. So if you're watching your breath and you can't stay with the breath, it means there's still things you have to throw away. You haven't done that yet. You get them back afterwards. It's just like sometimes you go on the aircraft and they ask you, have you got any sharp objects in your luggage? And if you have, you have to give them up and you get them back on the other end of the journey. So just like in meditation, madam, have you got any sharp objects like the past and future? I'm sorry, you have to check them in. You can't take them on board Buddha Air. Have you got any thoughts? I'm sorry, that's those liquids. You've got to check them in. You can't carry them on board. So if you want to board Buddha Air, this great meditation airline which goes to enlightenment, you've got to throw all these things out. You've got to check them in. Rather than carrying them in with your cabin baggage. They're not allowed on the path of meditation. You have to throw them away. And as you do throw them away, you go higher and higher and higher. So you're meditating there, and you've got the breath, you've thrown things away, and it doesn't become a beautiful breath. It means it's something you're still keeping. You haven't thrown away yet. And one of the things you're still keeping, which stops you going from the ordinary breath to the delightful breath, is you're still controlling too much. Just let go. Throw away this backseat driver, this controller, this thing which doesn't let the meditation develop. One of the similes which I said in the interview, which I haven't given here yet, which I don't think so, I think it was in the interview, is like the person who, when they leave this meditation retreat, they got to go to KL, so they get a taxi to the airport. So the taxi meets them at the front of this temple. And they get inside the taxi and they tell the taxi driver, I want to go to the airport. Now, I want you to drive slowly because I've just been on a meditation retreat. And please keep to the left and don't sound your horn because I've been meditating, I'm very sensitive. And don't drive too fast and don't brake too suddenly. And if there's anybody, because I've been practicing compassion, if anybody wants to come in front of you, let them come in front of you. I'm not in that much of a rush. Now please don't talk to me just when you're driving because I've been doing noble silence. You know, and please don't smoke because, you know, I'm into good health. You know, and please don't listen to your radio because I like to meditate when I'm in the taxi. And if you go on like that, imagine in real life, if you did that, that taxi driver would throw you out of the taxi before you got to the corner of Kampar Road. He'd say, listen, madam, if you want to go to the airport, I'll take you there. You sit in the back and shut up. And that's like what your mind does sometimes. Now come on, watch the breath. No, don't watch it this way, watch it that way. Now, Ajahn Brahm said you've got to watch it with kindness. And I mustn't do anything though, and I must sit straight. But it doesn't matter if I get dozy. And if there's a thought comes up, just be kind to it. And if I get sort of start nodding, that's okay. I can just not control my posture. And if you give all those instructions all at once, no wonder your mind throws you out. Say, I'm not cooperating with you, you control freak. So, all you need to do is to throw away all this and just say, watch the breath. And your taxi driver, like all the taxi drivers in Penang, they all know the way to the airport. They'll get you there in their own way. Your mind knows the way how to meditate. So you don't give it enough time, enough opportunity to do the meditation for you. So all you need to do is give the instructions and then throw everything else out. Throw away the controller. And that's one of the biggest things you have to throw out of your basket if you want to fly high in meditation. So when you get to a blockage, have a look. Why can't you go deeper? Is something you've got to throw out? Controlling. And that's one of the biggest things you have to throw out. As you go deeper in meditation, you're getting to the breath, it's delightful breath, then it's about to disappear. And you can't get the nimittas up. Why is that? What are you attached to? What aren't you throwing away? What you're throwing away at this stage is your body and all of your five senses. As I said before, that nimitta is the first time you can see the mind, the radiant mind, the sixth sense. And the reason it won't come up is because you can't let go of the body. Now that's a tough one for meditators to do, because sometimes that's scary. They think, my goodness, if I let go of this body, what's going to happen to it? Suppose I'm sitting here and I have to sit here like that Vietnamese monk for 9 more days. Does that mean that people are going to leave me here over the new year? Or is it dangerous? There was once this story of a monk, and he was sitting meditation in the forest, and he was so still sitting meditation, he got into obviously a jhana, and there were 2 men. They were foresters looking for wood or looking for herbs or mushrooms in the forest, and they saw this monk sitting there absolutely still. And they looked closely and he wasn't even breathing. And they thought, oh my goodness, the venerable has died. What should we do? We can't leave a monk dead in the forest. The animals will come and chew and eat him. That's not a respectful thing to do to our teacher. If you found me dead in a forest, would you just leave me there? No, of course not. But they can't carry him back to the village, it was too far. So what they decided to do, they were in a forest, there was lots of wood, so let's cremate him here. So they collected some wood and made a pyre, this big bonfire, and they picked up the sifu and plonked him on top. And then they lit the fire. They're going to cremate him. And as soon as the wood had caught light and it was burning well, he hadn't been cremated yet, but they thought, well, it's only a matter of time. Nothing can happen now. We're very busy people. So they went on with their business of collecting mushrooms and herbs in the forest, leaving the fire to do the business. So they cremated him. Now he wasn't dead, he was just in deep meditation. So you know what happened? Nothing. The following morning, he walked into the village on arms round. Not even his robes were damaged. And that's a very famous story which shows if you go into deep meditation, if you throw away your body and get into even nimitta stage, your body is perfectly safe. Even if after a couple of days you're in a deep meditation and doctors come and can't see you breathing and say, my goodness, she's dead, and they go and cremate you, they'll get a very big shock, because once they open the door of the crematorium, you'll still be there. Hi! Maybe they will die and need to be cremated. but you'll be fine. Even, that was an old story, even in my early years as a monk, there was, I don't know what's ever happened to him, but there was an Indonesian monk. And he was one of these monks who had psychic powers, a very strong-minded monk. I never understood what happened to him. This was about 33 years ago. But he told me his story before he became a monk. He was never interested in worldly things. So he decided to be a hermit, to go into the jungles. Now in Java, those days there were still lots of jungles. He went into the deep jungles to meditate. And interestingly, how he described it, I remember this. He said he looked at the sky, and he said he saw this star coming towards him. And it sort of enveloped him. And you know what that is, that's nimitta. He wasn't looking at the sky, this was in his mind. He got into a nimitta. He went into a very deep meditation, and he never knew for how long. And it turned out it was for several days. And when he came out of his meditation, in the jungle, he saw there was so much damage to the jungle around him. He checked with the villagers. Yes, there had been a big flood in that area for a couple of days. And he could see by the marks on the trees that he had been underwater for all those days, maybe 2 or 3 foot above his head, totally immersed. Number one, he hadn't known a thing about it. Number two, perfectly okay, survived. So that was a true story in my own lifetime about the fact if you get into these deep meditations, you're totally invulnerable. So you don't have to worry at all. You get into the deep meditation, no problem. Actually, this is another story somebody told me recently, just a couple of weeks ago. They told one of my secretary in Perth. I think I told you that about the Malaysian man who had a heart attack. I think I mentioned that already, didn't I? No? Okay. He wasn't a Malaysian, he was a German man staying in Malaysia. And he had a heart attack. And he felt sort of the pain in his chest. And before he fell unconscious, he was apparently one of my students, listening to all my talks on the internet and reading my book on meditation. And he said immediately he knew he was in trouble. Let go, let go, let go. And it's amazing, if you really have to, you will. And he did. He really let go very, very deeply. And apparently when he came to again, the medics were really surprised, because he'd been not breathing for 30 minutes. It took him 10 minutes to find him, do CPR for another 20 minutes, basically having given up on him. And when he came out, after 30 minutes of non-breathing, he was perfectly healthy, no brain damage, nothing wrong with him at all. And even so, the doctors were surprised, but he said, I'm not surprised, I knew exactly what happened, because I really let go and I got into a nice deep meditation for half an hour. So all my body was perfectly safe. And he rang up to say thank you for saving his life and saving his brain. So these things actually happen. If you really do let go, throw away your body, then it's perfectly safe. So that if you get to that stage that you have the delightful breath, or some people go to this nothingness state, it means you're still holding on to your body somewhere. So throw it away. All this seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, all this physical body. I've had all these bodies in my many lives. This is just another one. It's perfectly safe. Bye-bye, body. I'm going to enjoy myself. And if you find quite often that is the barrier between you and the nimittas, you just can't let go of that body. And it shows you actually how attached you are to your body. Even I remember, as many people have said this, but the first time it was a disciple in Singapore. They were meditating, and then they couldn't feel their hands. And as soon as they couldn't feel their hands, they came out of meditation and came to see me. They were terrified. Ajahn Brahm, what does it mean? I can't feel my hands. Is this some neurological, like MS? I'm going to sort of be paralyzed? I said, no, it's just nature. Just let go. You know, your hands are there all the time for you. Put them aside for a while. But because he'd never experienced that before, he was very afraid. He thought he was losing control of his whole body permanently. So when your body disappears, it's only temporary. You're leaving it alone. You're chucking it out of the basket so you can go much higher. So if that stays, just check. What are you holding on to? And it's usually your body, or some part of the body, or your hearing. So when you throw that out, this beautiful nimitta comes. Oh, it's really worth it. The higher you go in that balloon, the more wonderful is the view, and the more cool and pleasant is the air. So it's worth doing. Just throw away the body. It's perfectly safe. And unfortunately, it will be there for you afterwards. You have to pick it up and enjoy it afterwards. So there you are, just having a nice nimitta experience. But then it's not stable. Comes and goes, flashes, moves all over the place. Now that's not going to really help. Remember that this whole meditation is learning how to be still. So if your nimitta is moving, that means your mind is moving. You're moving. So the thing which you're holding on to at that particular stage, the more subtle form of control. You're holding on to your will. At that particular stage, I've given a few of you one of the nice similes. It's like you've been driving your car in the busy Penang traffic. And now I'm asking you to take your hands off the steering wheel, to take your feet off the pedals in the busy traffic, and totally let go. And that's what it's like when you're watching the nimitta. You really got to take your hand off all the steering wheels, feet off all the pedals, hands off all the levers, and stop controlling it. That's where you've got to throw away. Or, to make it even more interesting, you unscrew the steering wheel and you throw it out the window. You unscrew the pedals and throw them out the other window. So you can't control your car at all. Then the nimitta becomes really, really still. But sometimes you have that nimitta and it's very brilliant, and usually one of the first times people get into a jhana, they go in and they come out again. It's what I have called in my book yo-yo jhanas, like that little toy which kids used to have, you know, playing the yo-yo, goes up and down, up and down. Now yo-yo jhanas are pretty neat because you still get a heap of bliss. But it doesn't last. And the reason is, usually as one is going in, again, is more little control, the last bit of control. You've given it up, but you go outside and pick up the steering wheel, put it back on again, because it's just too powerful for you. You've really got to let go of controlling to enter those jhanas. So that is the thing you have to throw out. And if you throw all these things out, it means you really are practicing not to attain things, to let go of things, to see how detached, how empty, how few possessions you can have in your mind. It's like spring cleaning your mind. Past and future, thinking, all this worried about your body, worrying about controlling, all of that, throwing out. And when you throw it all out, it's perfectly, perfectly safe, and it means you get marvelous experiences of what it's like to be free and empty. So that's the second part of letting go, throwing things out, seeing what you're attached to, what's stopping you going deeper, noticing it, throwing it out. Now the next way of letting go, again, is one of my favorite ones. And it's an old story which I'm sure many of you have heard before, but it's a very funny story and it's worthwhile telling for those people who haven't heard of it. And that is the path of freedom, because that third way of letting go is called mutti, which means freedom. A lot of people don't understand what that word means, what it's like to be free. Because you don't have to be in a special place to be free. People in jail can be free. People with cancers can be free. People who are dying with a very painful body can be free. And they don't need to change anything. Because in order to understand what I mean, there is this story. And this was a story of one of my fellow monks going to teach in prison in Australia. And he'd been teaching many weeks when one of the prisoners invited him to stay behind a little bit longer. They wanted to give him a cup of tea and just talk to him, because they had some interesting questions, not just about meditation, but why he became a monk, and you know, how long he's become a monk, and what he thinks about it. And in particular, they wanted to find out, what do monks do? What is your schedule? They asked him. And at that point, he started describing a day in the life of a monk in our monastery in Australia. So he said, from the beginning, we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, he told the prisoners. And at that, the prisoners said, what? 4 o'clock in the morning? Even in prison, even the murderers don't have to get up that early. And that was when the monk said, well, actually, in Ajahn Brahm's monastery, it is optional. Getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning is optional. You can always get up earlier if you want to. That's the only option, but not later. And then what do you do? They said, can you watch the end of the late night movie? Because they have TVs in Australian jails. But do we have TVs in monasteries? No. We meditate in the morning. And they thought, well, fair enough, you're monks, we expect that. Then you have your breakfast. In Bodhinyana Monastery, we do have a breakfast, but it's usually one of these cups, and maybe just half full of muesli or cornflakes or something. Not like the breakfast you have here. The breakfast you have here, this is like Hilton Hotel. And the prisoner said, is that all they give you for breakfast? Just half a cup of muesli. He said, yeah. That's terrible, they said, even in jail. Now they have like a buffet here. They can have bacon and eggs. They can have pancakes. They can have cereal. They can have muesli or fruit. They have this whole, again, buffet, even probably more than you have here in prison in Australia. But then what do you do after breakfast? You know, can you play sport, have a game of tennis or football? I said, no, we don't play sport, we work in the mornings. And those of you who have been to our monastery, you know, have seen us work. We work very hard. If you don't believe me, just I think a day before I left to come to Singapore and Penang, we had, for those of you from KL, Dolly visited. Dolly Teo, she used to be, I think, the secretary of the BGF. And I was busy working, so she got a nice photograph of me, all with my work gear on, working in Jhana Grove. So I work really hard. And all the other monks work really hard. And when we told them how hard we work physically, those prisoners in Australia said, oh, they'll never get us to work that hard. No way, we'll go on strike. And sometimes even the prisoners refuse to work. And there's nothing much the Australian prison officers can do about it. So then what do you do for lunch? Now we have a lunch, but not like here. In the forest monasteries, we eat out of one bowl. And many of you have been to those monasteries, or you've been to visit me. Just have one bowl, and everything all goes into the one bowl. And many times it's happened, I've had ice cream on top of my curry. I remember once we had some spaghetti, some Western food, and custard went on top of it. Have you ever had custard on top of spaghetti? Does it sound disgusting? It tastes disgusting too. And the prisoners said, look, even in jail, they give you this metal tray, and you've got this curry or that potato or that rice, and the other half is for your sweets and your puddings. So we don't have that in monastery. It all slops into one bowl. That's disgusting. So what do you do after lunch? You know, can you play cards or play... What do you do to enjoy yourselves? Meditate. Ah, don't you get bored of meditating? And monks, some monks said, actually, yes. But good monks don't. They meditate all afternoon. Yeah, but what time do you have dinner? Dinner? We don't have dinner. That's our last meal. Just before lunch, before midday. They don't even feed you. Look, in prison, you can get afternoon tea as well as a huge dinner. Not in a monastery. Oh, that's sick. So what do you do in the evenings? You know, can you someone get a guitar and sing and play? No. Don't tell me, they said. Yep, we meditate. So what time do you guys go to bed? Bed, he said? We don't have beds. Most monks sleep on the floor. I said, even in solitary confinement they give you a bed to sleep on. And so when he described how ascetic an Australian Buddhist monastery is, the prisoners were just taken aback. They were surprised. They never imagined that a monastery compared to a prison would be so austere. That one of the prisoners, forgetting where they were, said to this monk they liked, out of compassion for him, "That's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" He got invited to stay in the prison. And the prisoners had a point. In Australia, it is much more comfortable being in prison than staying in a monastery. So if ever I have to go to jail, for me it would be a holiday. 3 meals a day, no work in the morning. Of course, I don't want to go to jail, never will go to jail. But it made me start thinking, what is the difference between a jail and a Buddhist monastery? Why is it in a monastery people love being there? And even you, now you fly all the way over from Penang or KL or Terengganu or Singapore to come and spend a week or two in my monastery. Why do you do that? Have you ever heard of anybody flying from KL to spend a week in prison voluntarily? What's the difference? And I realized the only difference between freedom and being in prison is that in a prison, people don't want to be there. That's why it's called a prison. And in a monastery, it can be more austere, but everybody in that monastery wants to be there, which is why they feel free. It made me understand that any place you do not want to be is prison for you. So if you're on this retreat and you can't wait till Tuesday when it ends, you don't want to be here, then Mahindarama Temple becomes Mahindarama Top Security Prison for you. If you're in your dormitory and you just hate it, your dormitory is a prison. Even if you're sitting meditation and having a terrible time, you just don't want to be here, then your meditation is a prison for you. Any place or situation you do not want to be is prison. And how do you escape from the prisons of life? How do you experience freedom? You don't have to leave this temple. You don't have to change your posture. You don't have to go anywhere else. To be free, you just change your attitude. From "I don't want to be here" to "I want to be here." If you're in dullness and you don't want to be in sloth and torpor, then your sloth and torpor is a prison. If you have sloth and torpor, okay, this is okay with me, I'm happy to be here, then you're free. If you've got a restless mind, "I don't want to be a restless, I want to sort of get concentrated," then your restlessness is now a prison. You don't want to be here. If you're restless and you say, "Okay, this is good enough for me, I'm content," then you're suddenly free. Any place you are, if you want to be here, in this moment, with this mind, no matter what it is, that is called freedom. It is the third way of letting go. Wanting to be here, but not wanting to be anywhere else, no matter what it is like. Monasteries are more austere, more painful physically than prisons. But I want to be here, therefore I'm free. There comes times in your life you've got sickness, you're in pain, and nothing can be done about it. If you say to yourself, even though it's hurting, I want to be here, that's the end of the problem, you're free. Otherwise, your pain becomes a prison for you. Now remember this in meditation, because a lot of times your obstacle which stops you getting deeper is you want to be somewhere else. Even some people have a nimitta, they've got a beautiful nimitta, and some of you think, my goodness, they're so lucky to have a nimitta. As for me, I can't even watch the breath for more than three breaths in a row, and they've got a nimitta, how lucky they are. But the one with the nimitta says, oh, this is no good, I want to get jhana. Even in a nimitta, if you don't want to be there, if you want to be somewhere else, that's suffering. That's not meditating. That's blocking your progress. So it doesn't matter what you're experiencing in meditation, whether it's a nimitta, whether it's sloth and torpor, whether it's the present moment or whatever, please, please, please want to be here. In every moment, want to be with this moment. That's called mindfulness. If you want to be somewhere else, you're not mindful anymore. Want to be here. Be content to be here. This is good enough. It means you feel totally free. You've got nowhere to go, no place you'd rather be, which means you're developing letting go. Now that is one of the most powerful ways of letting go. And if you want to be here, you're not interested in jhanas, not interested in nimittas, wherever you are, this is where you want to be. Your meditation just takes off. Fast track into the deepest meditations. Every moment, want to be here. I want to be here. I want to be here. Then you're content, you're still, and everything works. So check that out. If there's a blockage, it's probably you're meditating, you want to be somewhere else. You're walking, you want to be sitting. You're sitting, you want to be walking. You're in a beautiful stage of meditation, you want to be in the next stage. That's what stops you. So please, want to be here. And the last way of letting go, in the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, the first sermon, is Anālayo. It literally means having a non-stick mind. Because alaya, many people know that word from Himalaya and Meghalaya. Himalaya is the proper pronunciation of what we call the Himalaya. It means the abode of snows, it where snow sticks. Meghalaya is where the clouds stick. It's one of the states in the northeast of India. Alaya is having a sticky mind. And people do have a sticky mind. Someone says something to you and it sticks and causes you a problem afterwards. They call me an idiot. They call me a fool. They looked at you. What right are they to look at me like that? And it sticks to you. You've had a very difficult meditation. I'm hopeless. Don't let that stick to you. So every experience you have, as soon as it's finished, it's vanished without trace. A good meditation vanished without trace as soon as it's finished. Because those people with good meditations, that is also a problem. You just had a wonderful meditation and it sticks to you, which means I want it back. Want more, 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 more. And that stops you getting anywhere. So even the beautiful meditations, as soon as they finish, make sure they don't stick to you. Don't be attached to them. Don't be attached to anything. And if you have the non-stick mind, It is like the lotus again, where water, even dirty water or fragrant water, whether it's urine or whether it's fragrant scent, you pour it on a lotus leaf and it all falls off. Nothing sticks to it. As for you, a little bit of urine on your mind or fragrant water and it all sticks. So don't allow anything to stick. And that's the fourth way of letting go. A non-stick mind. Words, sounds, feelings, nothing sticks at all. So you're constantly fresh and empty. So those are the four ways of letting go, which were taught by the Buddha in a Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. So when people say the Buddha never told us how to let go, of course he did, and this is how to do it. Remember those four ways? The first is giving, expecting nothing back in return. So you give your mind, your energy to this meditation moment, you don't expect anything. You don't expect at the end of this retreat to get jhana, to get nimittas. You don't expect to get more better meditation than you got last time. This is an act of giving for you, giving these days to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. Not expecting anything back in return. Number two, seeing how many things you can throw away. Especially these attachments to body, to control, which you know people have. Throw everything away. Just be content to be here. Want to be here in every moment. This is good enough. Imagine in 3 or 4 days' time, many of you will be back at work. You'll be struggling in front of the computer screen, arguing with your boss, trying to get more work out of your employees, traveling through the busy traffic. Isn't it wonderful just to be here? Today you're free. So value every moment. Just want to be here. And lastly, let nothing stick at all. Even all of the teachings I've just given over the last 50 minutes. Don't try to remember them. That will block you. They're all there. It's one of the strange things which I've found in meditation practice. Sometimes I'm meditating. And when you come across a certain point, an instruction just comes up. And I thought, where did that come from? And I look at it and I remember, my goodness, Ajahn Chah told that to me 40 years ago, 30 years ago. And it's amazing, these meditation instructions, as soon as you hear them, they go in. You're already instructed. You're already brainwashed by me. You don't need to remember it, because you'll find at the right time and the right place, the instructions will come up. This is especially powerful in deep meditation. In ordinary life, there's just too many instructions. They just all come up. You don't know which comes from where. But in the deep meditation, sometimes some of you will be meditating, you come across a blockage, and an instruction will come up, and you think, my goodness, Ajahn Brahm told me that last year. And you'll find it's almost just been waiting there, waiting, stored in your subconscious, waiting for the right time to do its work. That's how I've experienced it, and that's how you'll experience it. So you don't need to gather things. Just trust in the process and have a non-stick mind. If you have too much knowledge, if you know too much, it just obstructs and complicates the path. So those are the four ways of letting go. And it's how we use wisdom and insight to actually develop in deep meditation. We know about attachments, because those are the things which we meet, which stop us, which we have to throw away. And the deeper you go in meditation, the more you learn about attachments. As you go deeper in meditation, the more you understand what freedom means. As you go deeper in meditation, you know more about this wonderful thing called emptiness. Not as a theory, but as your own experience. So as you practice more and more, insights not only help you go deeper and have more fun in your meditation, but they also teach you about the nature of yourself and the world in which you live. So that's the instructions for this morning. Are there any questions? Yep. How does one meditate on Dharma to gain wisdom? You're meditating. There's no other place to meditate but on Dharma. So in other words, you're getting very peaceful, very still, which means your mindfulness is increasing, you're seeing more. It's a natural process. You don't decide, now I will get insight. Insight comes to you. To go back to that simile of getting on the aircraft called Buddha Air. Once you get on the aircraft, you sit down in your seat and you buckle up, you don't move anymore. And after a few minutes, after you've taken off, the flight attendant comes up to give you what we call on Buddha Air, not the in-flight service, but the insight service. They come up to you and, sir, we have on the menu today anatta. Would you like to understand anatta? So, oh yeah, thank you very much, I'll have some of that. And so they give you the insight service, a big plate of anatta to digest. And so you learn about anatta. And maybe next course is anicca. Do you want anicca, sir? Oh yeah, that's very good. And we've also got the third part, it's a three-course meal, dukkha as well. So you don't go searching for these insights, they come to you. So as you become still, as you go deep in meditation, you understand what anicca means, what dukkha, what anatta means. It's served up to you on a plate. And later on in the flight attendant comes to you again and says, the lunch today we have nimitta. We have white nimitta, blue nimitta, yellow nimitta or green nimitta. Which one do you like? And said, oh, we had actually blue nimitta last time. I'll have the gold nimitta this time, thank you. So they give you the gold. You don't have to go and get it. You don't actually ring the flight attendant to go and order these things. They come to you. You just sit there and wait. And after the nimitta, they bring you the special course. The jhana. We have first jhana today, second, third, and fourth. Which one would you like? Maybe first jhana is enough today. And it's served up to you. You don't go chasing it. And of course, just before you land, they always give you the special courses just before you land. And there the flight attendant comes up and say, today we have on offer stream winning, once returning, non-returning or arahat. What's your choice? So I say, no, I'll have once returning please. All these things are served up to you on Buddha Air. You don't need to go up to the aisle and grab the flight attendant by the collar, shake them and say, give me arahat please. If you act like that, you know, you get banned from flying ever again. So you just sit in your seat and wait, and these things come to you. And that's actually how insight works. Don't go searching for insight. Sit down, be still, and insight comes to you. That's why I call it the insight service on Buddha Air. All part of the airfare. No extra charge. Not like one of these budget airlines where you have to pay extra to get anything to eat. This is all part of the fair. Any other questions? Okay. So do you want to be here? Or do you want to be somewhere else? Okay, maybe you want to go toilet, maybe you want to sort of go somewhere else right now, but when you're meditating later on, see if you can remember just that simile of just wanting to be here. This is really good enough for me. I'm just giving my whole energy, my mind to this moment. And I don't expect anything, don't want anything back in return, and happy to be here. Wherever this happens to be. Then you go deep. Sorry? So I couldn't hear because of the fan. Could you shout up? As a path disappears. Oh yeah, that was the saying yesterday. The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Is that the one? So I still can't hear you because of the fan. What did you say? I can't hear you either. Kasapa. Oh, Kasapa disappeared. Oh, okay. Oh, that one, yeah. According to the legend, because no one actually knows what happened to him, we know that Sariputta Moggallana died before the time of the Buddha. And before the Buddha died, rather, and we know about the Buddha's death. And after they were passed away, there was Kasapa was one of the elders. There was Anuruddha, there was Ananda. But Kasapa was supposed to be, you know, the elder, the one in charge. And according to the legends, that there was no legend of him dying. But what he did do, he was once given the robe and the bowl of the Buddha, and he went into this mountain. And he went there to meditate and went into one of these deep meditations, says he's not going to come out of meditation until the next Buddha, Maitreya, arises, so he can give the bowl and robe to Maitreya. So that was the story. And for a long time no one knows where that mountain is. But I think that one of the Chinese travelers, he described that mountain, and I think recently people have found that mountain. But there's Chicken Foot Mountain, yes. But there's no sign of Kasapa. Maybe he's inside in a deep cave, still meditating with the Buddha's robe and his bowl. Who knows? That's a legend, that he never died, that he's still meditating in deep, deep stillness. But anyway, he's not going to come out anyway till Maitreya comes. And that's going to be a long, long time. A long time after 2012, when the world's going to end anyway. So it's not going to end in 2012. So that's the story of Kasapa. Ah, the Buddha giving a flower to Kasapa. There's no record of that story in the Theravada canon. So it sounds not really, it's probably would be added afterwards. Because anyone who knows Mahakasapa from the Pali canon, he was one of these monks who hardly ever smiled, if he smiled at all. So handing him a flower is totally out of character. He was one of these really tough guys. He was more like today, like an Ajahn Mahabua. For those of you who have gone to see Lungta Mahabua, that's a sort of more like the character, but even tougher, of Kasapa. So that story is not in the Theravada canon. It could have happened, but it doesn't sound likely to me. But that's Kasapa, still meditating in a cave, maybe. Okay, so that's all, by the way. Okay, yeah, last question. That's a very good question. It seemed that in the original type of Buddhism, there was only one or two Buddhas, but then afterwards there was many more were created. And it's supposed to be like a Buddha in a long, 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 long distant future, way after Maitreya. But then the legend grew and grew and grew and grew. But the idea of Amitabha means unmeasured radiance, limitless radiance. And that whole idea of Amitabha, some of you already have actually touched nimittas, which are so powerful and so radiant, you think you're going blind. Powerful nimittas. You never go blind because that nimitta is seen with the mind, not with the physical eye. But sometimes people feel that and they say that. Now you get some idea of what Amitabha actually is, the limitless radiance of the mind when it gets pure in meditation. So instead of worrying about is there an Amitabha, is there not an Amitabha, and sort of upsetting some people who devoted their whole life to Amitabha, to say, well, yeah, we can find Amitabha in our deep meditation. And that is not a being, but the limitless radiance of your mind when it gets deep in meditation. So that's a nice diplomatic way of not upsetting people. By saying, yeah, I don't believe in this, or I believe in it.
Does that make any sense to you?
Not really. So, if there's other beliefs and other people there, they believe in the Pure Land and Amitabha, and they think that all they need to do is to chant the name Amitofu, and then they get to the Pure Land, and then they become enlightened from there. Sometimes it's not nice, you know, as a fellow Buddhist, to keep arguing with people and challenging them. Who's got the best type of Buddhism? It's best actually just to understand the Dhamma as best you can, and see if you can take the best qualities, you know, from every other type of Buddhism, every other type of religion, and incorporate them into your practice. So don't be like an extremist Theravada who's going to fight a jihad and a war on anybody else who doesn't agree with you totally. Because wherever you find something useful, make use of it. So when I heard Amitabha, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, that was something which came a long time after the Buddha's teaching, after he passed away. And some of the teachings don't make any sense to me. But when I heard the word Amitabha, you can recognize that, what it means. And that's something which I do worship. The radiant, beautiful mind. And leave it at that. Okay, so now's the time to meditate rather than speculate. And for those people who want to have interviews, be down in the interview room in another 5 minutes' time. And have a happy morning. And remember, even though you may think there's, 3 days left? 3 days is 72 hours. 72 hours is 4,320 minutes, which is almost 250,000 seconds or something like that. So 250,250,000 seconds to go before the end of this retreat. And you only need 1 second to get full enlightenment. So you've got 250,000 opportunities. So don't think, oh my God, the retreat's almost over. You've got thousands, hundreds of thousands of opportunities. So stay cool and be patient. Don't panic yet. Okay. See you, Doug.